Hello, friends. How nice to be with you again. We're happy to be sharing this afternoon. As you can see, we're a little more informal this afternoon than we are during the daily classes that we've been having.
And we brought our own tea. So if you would like to get your own tea while the questions are going on, we can have tea together. And
we had a friend who called tea personality in a cup. So that's kind of a helpful thing to have this time of day sometimes. We used to often have tea with Swami about this time.
Okay, so maybe we have a lot of questions that people...
We should start with a prayer, I think.
Yeah, but I just want to say we have a lot of questions that people have sent in, and we also have questions that people are sending in right now as we speak. So we'll try to give rather brief answers and hope we can get through most of them. So you want to start with a prayer?
Okay. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, great saints and sages of all religions, we humbly bow to you all. Bless us with thy guidance and with thy grace. Help us clear all obstacles, all sheaths of delusion that keep us from knowing that we are one with thee. Om, peace, amen. Let's just for a moment get centered. Om, shanti, shanti, shanti. So those who have sent in questions already, we have kind of grouped them into similar questions in so that we can maybe answer some more fully and then in reference to that answer others more quickly. So I'll just start. Why is Babaji regarded as the highest avatar? Sri Yukteswar says Babaji's spiritual state is beyond human comprehension. The avatar's attainment is inconceivable. Isn't that just as true for Sri Yukteswar or Jesus or Master? Haven't all avatars attained the same spiritual state? That's a very good question, very perceptive. In fact, all avatars have attained the same spiritual state. And beyond avatars, all what one might call siddhas, those who have attained final liberation, they too have attained the same state. And so you cannot say that one is greater than another. But what you can say is that certain great souls, certain avatars, have a bigger world mission to do. And in that sense, Babaji's world mission is not only huge, but it is it's ongoing. So Master says in the autobiography that Jesus and Babaji are responsible for the spiritual guidance of the entire planet, and that's been going on for a long time. So those are big responsibilities. Now, you might also note that Babaji being in the body, Jesus not in the body, what does it matter to them? Their consciousness is the reality. But Babaji is the, one might say, chief executive of the earth, and his office is a cave in the Himalayas. He doesn't work in the same way that we work outwardly. But coming back to the question, all avatars are at the same level spiritually, but some have a bigger world mission to do. And Babaji has reincarnated again and again to help guide the world. So he was Krishna in a former lifetime. Before that, he was Nara, and he and Master often incarnate together. They were Nara and Narayan in a former life, very ancient life in India. Then Krishna and his chief disciple, one might say, Arjuna. In this life, Babaji and Yogananda. So they come at times of world change to help guide the planet. But Swami met Swami Rama, who was also liberated, and he lived alone with about five devotees. And Swami said, with all your great attainment, why don't you do more for the world? And Swami was absolutely charmed by Swami Rama's answer. He said, God has done what he wants through this body. He didn't identify with his ego. So bigger role, lesser role, they're all at the same level spiritually, but Babaji is so widely considered to be this great avatar that, and certainly in our lineage, he's like the eldest of the equals. So.
Okay, I'll go on to the next.
You do the next.
Okay. Are samadhi and liberation the same, or are they different? No, they're different. Samadhi, no, I'm just speaking from book knowledge here. I have to be perfectly honest. So I'll tell you what I know from what I've read, not from what I've experienced. So there are two different states of samadhi. There's a lesser state, sabbakalpa, and then a higher state, nirvikalpa. And samadhi is a state of consciousness where you are in deep ecstatic union with all of creation. Master expresses, describes it in Autobiography of a Yogi in a chapter in Cosmic Consciousness. And, excuse me. But liberation means, one might say, one experiences samadhi, and from those exalted states, little by little, all karma, all sense of separate identity dissolves. But it's still, one can attain sabbakalpa samadhi, the lower state, and still fall, go back into worldly consciousness. But once you have attained the higher state, nirvikalpa, then you never lose it. You can always return to it at will. However, it still doesn't mean you're free of all karma. That liberation means free of all karma. That's what the avatars are. And so we can have these exalted states, but to really do the purifying, intense discipline that cleanses all karma, then that's when we reach a state of liberation where we are not compelled to come back, but only come back to a body and a worldly existence. But we only come back if we choose to.
Next question is, Master says in a talk that he does walkie-talkie with us, and it's one side. Please advise us on how to be in tune with Master in every moment, every thought and activity, so I respond to his walkie-talkie and act accordingly. Well, walkie-talkie is, his didn't come from a Radio Shack. You know, it's a intuitive connection. Now, Master, being a master, was already in everyone's mind. So when he does walkie-talkie, it's not like he's separate from the, he's both the sender, he's the sender, and he knows the consciousness of the receiver. But so he sends a message, and we have to develop our intuition sufficiently to pick it up, because it isn't in words, it isn't written, it's an intuitive vibrational message that's sent. And there's a whole teaching on how to develop your intuition. In fact, we have a book on specifically on that subject.
Intuition for starters,
which is a series of talks that Swami gave that and Devi edited them. It's a wonderful book. But essentially, intuition comes from the deeper we are able to go into a sense of unity the more our intuition develops. The more we are an ego or separative consciousness, the less intuition comes into play, and more the conscious mind is then more operative. So there are multiple ways to work on your intuition, but once you work on that, Jaya gave a good quote from Master. Master said that if you can feel joy in meditation and then hold on to that joy during daily activities, then you will be intuitively guided to the right path in every decision. So the same might be said for developing our side of the walkie-talkie. The more we can live in joy or live in peace or live with universal love, if we live in a unitive consciousness, then we're much more able to pick up on the unitive consciousness of Master that is sending us a specific message or a specific guidance. So we could really do a long series of classes on developing intuition, and there are some already recorded classes on that, but basically that's the answer.
And I'm gonna, just on a lighter note, I'd like to share a little story about walkie-talkies to kind of highlight the intuitive way that our teachers in our Living Wisdom schools work with the students. Once we were visiting one of the classrooms, and we saw a big, I think it was about a fourth grade classroom here at Ananda Village, and there was a big map on the wall with these red X's. It was a map of Ananda Village with these red X's marked all over it. And I asked the teacher, "What is that?" And he said, "One of the boys in the class gets very, very restless. And rather than just trying to suppress him and get mad at him and make him feel guilty about it, I give him a walkie-talkie and say, 'Now go ride your bicycle.' And he's got one and I've got one. And let's see how far the range of the walkie-talkie is. And if we have a signal, then we'll make an X on the map." And we were so delighted. And the boy is now an adult grown-up. But just working with people's realities, as we were talking about this morning. Okay, so here's a question, not about walkie-talkies. I've heard not to practice Kriya as a merchant. How is praying for guidance and God's blessings any different than the tit-for-tat approach of the merchant? Okay, that's a good question. Because when we say don't practice Kriya as a merchant, what you want to do is not say, "Okay, Master, I've given you 14 kriyas, where's the bliss?" You know, but do it with a sense of self-offering, never with a sense of what you're going to get in return. And that's different from asking God for his bliss, for his guidance, for his blessings. But if there's a merchant consciousness, I guarantee you, you'll find a number of obstacles on the spiritual path, and you won't make good progress. But if you can do your kriyas, do your meditation, just say, "Master, whatever I experience, that's in your hands. I'll do my part, and I'll try to meditate the best I can. Whatever fruits I reap, I will wait to receive them from your hands."
Swami Kriyananda used to jokingly use as the standard for somebody who had that merchant consciousness whether their meditation was able to produce a parking place in downtown San Francisco. I had a really deep meditation this morning because I found a parking place right away, right in front of the store I wanted to go to. He would laugh about that, as you can well imagine. Okay. How can I learn to view life as a movie, as Master said, when we're caught in the middle of the drama? And Jyotish said, in past talks, he mentioned this world is a dream, an illusion. Are the connections we have with individuals eternal, or are they just part of the play? Okay, the first part, how can we view it as a movie? the more attached we are to something, a result, a relationship, anything, the more attached we are, the more we're stuck in that, one might say, place and time, reality, and it's hard to be unattached. One time we were watching, we had gone to the movie Chariots of Fire with Swami in San Francisco. And there's a scene in it, for those of you who have seen, it's a very nice movie about Olympic athletes from Great Britain. And there are two particular stars, and they're both sprinters. And one has just tried and worked and strained and done everything possible, and he's completely, totally focused on winning Olympic gold medal. And in his best event, the 100-meter dash, he loses. And now he's running his second best event, which is the 200-meter dash. And he's just, it's his whole life to win this race, and the movie portrays it with this big theme behind it in ultra slow motion. You see the foot going like this, and the music building, and the actors straining, and it's coming toward the middle of the race, and he's just maybe going to pull into the lead. And Swami taps us on the shoulder and says, "It's kind of hard to remain unattached during a moment like that, isn't it?" And of course we laughed, but the more caught up in something you are, the harder it is to see life as a dream. So one thing that you can do is to try to, if you're really attached and you're wondering about a course of action or how to get unattached, imagine that you're giving instead of, "Oh, I have to have this." If a good friend of yours came to you with that same question or that same problem or that same attachment, what advice would you give them? So if a good friend came and, "I'm so worried about this, it's just, it's the only thing I have in life," what would you tell them? You tell them, "Just calm down, it's not the whole of life," you know? So project, get a little distance between you and yourself. And then the next question, are relationships eternal? Well, some are eternal. The guru-disciple relationship is eternal. Are relationships between individuals eternal? Yes and no. I mean, Buddha said, I think it was Buddha who said, "You have been related at one time or another closely to everyone on the planet." Now, even with a smaller population during his time, that's rather unimaginable. And certainly in this lifetime, you only have a fraction. And so I suspect that those relationships that are more on a human level, they come and they'll pass. But those that are on more of an eternal level, I think they'll stay. And certainly the guru-disciple relationship is one of those. But I suspect your brothers and sisters in a blood-related sense, you may not have much of a relationship in 8 or 10 lifetimes. But your brothers and sisters spiritually, you may retain those relationships for a very long time because you're moving together into eternity, which is beyond time and space.
Okay, I'm going to just tag on a little bit to what Jyotish said. First of all, a story about watching movies with Swami. We were not personally present for this one, but a friend told us that what had happened, she and her husband invited Swami and a few others. It was her birthday, so they invited them into town, Nevada City, our local town, for a nice dinner and then to go see a movie. She hadn't seen the movie before. And so they were watching the movie, and all of a sudden you could tell that a big love scene was coming, and she thought, oh, this is going to be embarrassing with Swami here. But then, just then, Swami was trying to adjust his hearing aid, and it popped out, and it was on the floor of the movie theater. And he said, oh, I lost my hearing aid. And they all were down on the floor looking for Swami's hearing aid. Finally, they found it, and they looked up, and the love scene was over. So that's watching a movie with Swami. And then I just have to share a story, because Jyotish has been, since I've known him, he just sees life with a little bit of wry humor, whatever it is. And some of you know the story, but some of you don't. When we had the big fire in 1976, and everything, the whole community burnt down, our house and everything we owned burnt down, Jyotish and I were on opposite parts of the property when it was happening, but finally, when things settled down toward the end of the afternoon, we found each other. And I didn't want him to be worried for me and the newborn child that we had, 10 days old. He was trying to be real positive, but he put a big smile on his face and he said, the dome we had lived in that burned down, he built it, and it leaked really badly when it rained. And so he looked at me and he said, you know, we don't have to worry about leaks anymore. And we both burst out laughing. That was not an easy moment in our lives, but we could still see that it was a drama. We hadn't lost our joy. So I wanted to share those little tidbits. Okay, next question. How do we define a balanced life for a householder with many responsibilities? Are there specifics to this? Well, yes, there are. You know, if you recall on Monday, when we gave the class on how to live the autobiography of a yogi, we quoted that passage from the chapter, I Joined the Swami Order, from Autobiography, in which Master says, to fulfill one's worldly responsibilities is the higher path, provided it is done with non-attachment and to getting involved with the details of that life. And so, yes, as a householder, why would he say it's a higher path? Because it's more demanding. You know, if you're just living by yourself, you don't have responsibilities, job, expenses, partner, children, all of that, life is relatively simple. But if you can keep your mind fixed on God in the midst of all that, that's not an easy thing to do. And fortunately, in the Ananda communities, we have beautiful examples of people doing just this. How do you do it? Make sure you never let up on your sadhana. No matter how busy it is, no matter how demanding it is, you find time for meditation, for your relationship with God, for your walkie-talkie. And I know when our child was first born, such was his temperament that whenever I sat to meditate, it could be 2 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 10 o'clock in the morning in the middle of a nap for him, he would always wake up and start crying. And I finally figured it out. He was sensing that I was withdrawing my energy from him, from the world, and it threw him off. And so for about a year, after having meditated regularly for 7 years, I really couldn't meditate much. But what I did was once a week, I met with another mother one evening, and we meditated. We had a long meditation together outside of the house. And so keep that core of your sadhana fixed, and then try to have this inner detachment. Try to, don't think this is my wife or my husband or my child or my house. It's all God's. Ramakrishna said, we should live in the world like a maidservant who goes to the rich man's house every day, keeps it tidy, prepares the meals, tends the children, but then at the end of the day, she returns to her own home. And this, it's a good image, because think about all the things you do. These children, these responsibilities, they're not yours. You're just playing a part. And so it's a wonderful opportunity and very, very important in this day and age to show a high level of consciousness in the householder lifestyle.
And just to say, if it's the right karma for you, being a monk is just, it would be unfortunate to compare one as higher and one as lower. It's just whatever the karma is. And sometimes it's helpful for people to understand that life is not always easy just because you're on the spiritual path. Our son was very, very energetic and demanding. Davies told one part of it, but we had a little geodesic dome, and we had a loft, sleeping loft, and kind of a stairs up to it. And by the time our son got old enough to stand, so from 6 months on, one might say, in the middle of the night, we would hear this thump. And then a little while later, our son would come crawling up the stairs to where we were sleeping. And so we realized that what he was doing, we had a crib, and he would hold onto the crib, and he would bounce and bounce and bounce until he got enough momentum to throw himself over the edge. And then we'd hear the thump as he landed on the floor. So naturally, being smart parents, we built up a higher level. And that held him for a week or two, and then we'd hear a thump. And this time, of course, he'd fallen from a higher level. Well, that went on about three levels until finally we realized he's going to really hurt himself if we keep building it up higher and higher. So we just put a little mattress on the floor for him. And when he woke up in the middle of the night, he crawled up and came to see us. But God sends you the appropriate challenges that you need. So next. If one is called upon to serve or help someone, but it's taking me away from my meditation routine, what should come first? Should one be assertive and have strong boundaries, or see all requests as a duty? That's not an easy answer. There's no exact right way or wrong way. I would say you have to discriminate between why are you being called on to help? You know, if it's a really ill partner or parent and you're taking care of them, then you should forego your meditation routine, still meditate, but put their needs first. But if it's somebody who just is demanding all the time, I sometimes like to use the image that some people want you to carry their luggage for them. They can carry it themselves, but why should they if they can get you to carry their luggage for them? So if it's somebody who just wants you to carry their luggage, then you should set boundaries. So discriminate between whether there's just a real need for them calling on you for your help, or whether it's just kind of a habit pattern. If it's a habit pattern, then you need to set boundaries. If you do that thoroughly enough, the world will kind of gradually part its way so that that you'll be able to do what you need to do in terms of your spiritual life. God will help you with this, but he will also help you spiritually if you serve when you're really, really called upon to serve.
So the next question is, and this is one we get asked a lot. I have to say, particularly in India, we get asked this question a lot. I'd love to hear your guidance about relationships, especially close partner, marriage, family. How do you discern when a situation is toxic or too negative versus this is karma, one should stay in a situation to learn? How do we know? The question is it me needing to learn something versus I gotta get away from this person? Our relationships are such a big part of life. I don't wanna leave relationships that serve, and I don't wanna stay in relationships that are negative or destructive. So the question essentially is, how do I know if it's me needing to learn something or I gotta get away from this person? Well, that's the question. And it's a moving target in a way, because if you have a disharmonious relationship, I think the starting point is to say, what can I do to change, to bring more harmony into this relationship? Without being defensive, without being, you know, blaming the other person, what do I need to change? What do I need to learn? And then you do your best to really make those adjustments and to be humble and sincere with the person. And Jyotish and I learn this all the time. If some disharmony has come up, you just say, you know, that was my fault. I shouldn't have said that, or I didn't mean it that way, or whatever. But just to have a softness around the edges so the big barriers don't grow. But having done your best, if the other person is still always angry or always blaming you or whatever, demanding, then and you know that you have done your best, then I think you can fairly say, and you have to be very self-honest, this relationship is not serving my highest aspirations to live in peace and harmony. And Swami generally advised people to try to work marriages out, but there were instances where he said, no, a divorce is justified because this relationship is blocking you from your spiritual life and your dharma. So it takes to discern, we have to be the judge ourselves. And you have to be honest, you have to do your best and work hard. And if you know you've done that and it still isn't working, then offer it to God and say, I think I need to move on.
It really comes down to whether deep spiritual principles are involved. There you have to be firm. And if that's really threatened in a relationship, then you may have to move on. But if it's a matter of likes and dislikes, my way or your way, there you have to soften up the edges and try to find compromises. So, next one. How do I apply to daily living being honest with civility? As Sri Yukteswar says, candor with courtesy is helpful and admirable. Well, there's, how to put it? There's honesty and then there's helpful honesty. And Master and Swamiji both advised to use helpful honesty, but not unhelpful honesty. Swami used this example. If you were to go into a hospital room when a person maybe had had a serious operation and was doing the best to gather strength and begin the recovery process, to go in, and even though it would be factually honest to look at the person and say, you look terrible. You look like you may not make it. Maybe that would be an honest thing to say, but is it a helpful thing to say? So Swami, using that example, said it's much better to say something, wow, you look much better than might have been, than many, many other patients would look after this kind of an operation, which would be true, and yet is not dishonest, but it is moving in the right direction. So ask before you think that the world needs your opinion on this weighty matter. Ask whether your opinion is helpful or not. When confronted with something where you're kind of forced to give an answer, I would say give, again, the answer that can be helpful, but don't be dishonest and don't be disingenuous. It's better to say, I'd rather not discuss it right now, or something of that sort, than it is to say something that would make you feel patently false simply because you're trying to make peace. So it's a fine line in there, but try to tread that line and just do your best. But kindness kindness, generally speaking, trumps candor.
And just to add a little bit to that, it's actually kind of fun because you try to think, what can I say that's honest but at the same time supportive? And I believe it was Swami, it might have been Master, but people would bring their babies up to him and, you know, isn't my baby beautiful? And some of them were, and some of them were kind of funny looking, as some babies are at first. And as I say, I think it was Swamiji. And so he finally came up with the phrase, now that's a baby. And it kind of leaving it, you know, without committing one way or the other. So it's sort of fun to find ways to that you can be supportive, but at the same time honest.
Now, since she brought it up, I just have to tell you all about my very, I came at one time very close to shifting careers from being, you know, head of Ananda Sangha to a cupcake model or cupcake spokesman. This is the way it took place.
This is a true story.
True story. So a friend of ours is involved with the Los Angeles Auto Show. And the night before the big opening event, there's a big kind of gala fundraising event where all the luminaries from the town, the city of Los Angeles and area, they come and they pay quite a big amount, $200 or $300 to come and
it's that a charity
goes,
event.
Yeah, it goes to charity. And so they have these big spreads of food. Well, we were there one time and they had the pyramid of cupcakes. So imagine a tier about, I suppose, started at the base 8 feet across, and then the next tier 6 feet across, and then 4 feet across, all filled with designer cupcakes.
Everyone was different.
Everyone different, and everyone a designer one. And of course, this being LA and Hollywood, they had a film crew from the Food Channel filming all of this. So you had to sign a disclosure, disclosure that you can use my image and whatever I say and so on. Then if you did that, then you could get a cupcake and you were supposed to take a bite, and then you could they would film that, and then some of those would go up on the Food Channel. So all the ladies, they were really into it, let me say. I hope that isn't going to get me in trouble later on, but they were really into it. So they all
got there. Why don't you just say, the other people than me were all into
it. Everybody except me was into this. And I was in the corner kind of winding one leg around the other leg, hoping to avoid the whole thing. But no, I couldn't. They said, Jyotish, you have to do it, you have to do it. So I did it. And I took a bite of the cupcake and I said my little spiel and just forgot about it. Then about 4 months later, I got this call from a friend who was on the East Coast. She said, Jyotish, I just saw you on the Food Channel. She said, my family has all these TVs and they had the Food Channel on, and all of a sudden I heard your voice and I looked up and you were giving a little thing about a cupcake. And so what I did was I took a bite of the cupcake and looked with a steely gaze right into the camera and said, now that's a cupcake. And that's what made it onto the Food Channel. So I figured the offers were going to start coming in. Could you be our, you know, a spokesman for our product?
And whenever we were in L.A. and we would go to a coffee shop, we'd say, I wonder if they would recognize me and give me a free cupcake. And they never did.
They had been well trained not to bother stars by trying to get their autograph or whatever.
Okay, we totally lost the track. I don't even know where
we've gone into left field here.
Okay. We'll just be dutiful and go through the questions. Okay. Here's a career question. I find it feels harder and harder to be in a system, parentheses medicine, that feels more corrupt by the day. It is feeling almost impossible to stay in my role in the system and be in alignment in my heart and the teachings of Christ, Master, and all the great saints. Could you comment on this challenge? Well, These are changing times, you know, and particularly during the pandemic, we're getting so many conflicting facts about alternate facts about this is true and that's true and this is good and that's not good. And, you know, obviously there is corruption in big pharmacies and they're charging huge, you know, making millions off of people's need for prescription medications. But I think, as in any career, if you, you know, let's say a legal profession or a policeman or a teacher, where you hear about a lot of corruption in the system, I think all we can do is try to live our own life with integrity and remember, why did I get in this profession to begin with? Why did I become a policeman or a doctor or a lawyer? Part of it is a, you know, lucrative career, no doubt, but part of it is to help people and just try to cling to that and do the best you can. If your job as it is just becomes intolerable, then try to find a more service oriented profession. We had a friend whose father was part of Doctors Without Boundaries, which does, you know, social free social medicine throughout the world. There are many ways that it can still be practiced with integrity and with a spirit of service to humanity. So do your best to live your own life according to your own principles. If it becomes impossible in the job, particular job you find yourself in, then look for another alternative. And just pray that Master use you as an instrument for his service and help to alleviate suffering of others.
As Davy and I travel around, we sometimes get this question. In some areas, let's say business has a looser relationship with the Patanjali's restriction of non-lying. And so some people are told that they have to tell lies in the job. So they either are supposed to tell lies about the product or about when a shipment is coming or those kinds of things, or they're going to lose their job. And it's a very difficult position to be in. And as Davy and I travel around, that's one of the questions we commonly get. Just this, where's the dividing line between my need to provide for my family and a sense of being able to stay with Dharma? And it's not always an easy question, but generally speaking, the answer is do everything you possibly can to be dharmic and not tell lies or hurt people or any of the adharmic things, unrighteous things that might be being asked of you to do. And if it comes to the bottom line and you have to change jobs or change professions, it's better to stay with a sense of personal integrity than it is to compromise beyond what you feel is a rightful thing to do. Your integrity you will carry with you after you leave this earth, and if you allow yourself to be forced to be adharmic in this life, as I was talking this morning, you'll carry those ridges in your channel in succeeding lifetimes. Your job, that's going to pass either before you die or when you die. So it's personal integrity is more important.
Okay, maybe I'll take the
next question.
But I've looked up some of Paramahansa Yogananda's recipes online and noticed that they allow for the use of onion, mushroom, and garlic. Are these not considered tamasic foods that will make the mind heavy and thus make it difficult to meditate? So, first of all, onion and garlic are not tamasic according to Ayurveda. They're rajasic, activating. Mushroom is considered tamasic. But there's a passage we were focusing on conversations with Yogananda, and there's a passage where some of the monks came to Master and said, "We don't like the diet that's being served here." And Swami said, "In fact, it wasn't the greatest diet, focusing heavily on macaroni and cheese." But Master didn't give into it. He didn't say, "Oh, we're going to change it." He just said, "You take what's given to you." So that's one aspect. But with garlic and onions, you know, you just have to feel for yourself. So many people, like you'll read, "Oh, this is bad for, you know, onions are rajasic," and so you eat them and you feel. Be honest, eat food that has these things in it. Do you feel it affects you? Do you feel it's affecting your meditation? For most of us, it's too subtle. If it's done in moderation, that's the point, moderation. Just speaking personally, a friend of mine gave me a wonderful cookbook, and I'll just say the name. It's Ayurvedic Cooking for a Calm, Clear Mind. And it's without onions, without garlic, with different blends of Indian spices. We're enjoying it very much, particularly in the evening when it does seem to calm the mind. But for our luncheon meal, I use garlic and onions and things like that, and I find that helpful. So it's all a matter of balance. Spicy foods or hot foods are also very rajasic. If you use too much of them, it will imbalance your system. So really, I think it's a matter of finding what works for you and then looking and living, taking your diet with a sense of balance and not in excess of anything. And Master really said, it was interesting, he said, "My first generation of students, I told them, try to eat a little less meat. My second generation of students, I said, try not to eat red meat, only fish or chicken. Third generation, I said, do not eat meat at all." And he said, those were the healthiest, that third generation. But he said, "I don't like to call it vegetarianism. I call it proper eatarianism." Because again, everyone has to find what works for you. And for some people, a certain food, a certain kind of diet, you'll really thrive on it. For others, not. So it's individual. But basically, I think a diet of fresh fruits, vegetables, lightly cooked vegetables, whole grains, fresh juices. This is something that should be the kind of the foundation of your diet. And then you can play around the edges.
Okay, now the next two are on the topic of food and drink too, but these are very serious next questions. What is your view on coffee? I've been trying to quit unsuccessfully for the last 3 years. I've only been able to reduce my intake somewhat.
We're not making fun of you, whoever asked this question.
No, we aren't either, because I've worked my way through this. I, in fact, am quite a bit in the camp of Mark Twain, who said, quitting smoking is easy. I've done it 1,000 times. Meaning that he'd quit and then smoke again. And then the second part is, I definitely notice that if I have some even 4 hours prior to my evening meditation, it is very hard to achieve deep concentration. What would you recommend in that regard? Well, I'll talk about coffee, but this is true for all things. You know, Davey gave an answer about that Swami said to the woman who said, that she had a lifestyle where she went to cocktail parties and had cocktails. And Swami said, well, understand this, that this is tamasic and it will pull your consciousness down. But he also said, but never identify yourself with any habit that you may have. So don't say, I'm a coffee drinker. Say, I have a habit of drinking coffee. Because you are not your habits. So having said that, there are some habits that maybe you know are not good for you, but you can't quit. That's an addiction. That's the definition of an addiction, that there's something that you do that is harmful to you, but you still can't stop. So let's say a coffee addiction. There's a chemical part to it, And so if you're wanting to stop drinking coffee, don't try to go cold turkey. Reduce the amount of coffee that you're drinking. Certainly start with, don't drink 4 hours before your evening meditation. Maybe confine your coffee drinking to what you have in the morning, but reduce it until you're taking just a little bit, because there's a brain chemical, which I won't go into, but you get headaches if you go cold turkey off of caffeine. So reduce it until you're able to go without it. Then try to stay within the addiction. Stay completely away from that for long enough for any chemical addiction to wash out of your system, any brain imbalance or anything like that. Master drank coffee for a while, and then he said, I was getting used to it, and I missed not having my coffee. So I said, I'm not going to let it control me. So I quit and don't have it anymore. So it's not like coffee is terrible, sinful, awful, but anything that controls you, as yogis, we should try to not allow that to happen. So reduce your intake, and in this case, I would say if it's controlling you, then give it up completely and do something else instead. Exercise, or instead of a cup of coffee, do a second set of energization or something to substitute for that until it's washed out of your system. And then if you're completely clear from something that is not necessarily harmful, then to have a little bit once in a while. That's different from being addicted and habituated and can't do without it.
Okay, so we don't have a whole lot of time left, and we have some online questions that have come in. So we'll try to make our answers for the rest more brief so we can answer everyone's questions. This next one is, when Yogananda takes on karma of his disciples, he does so very consciously. When you speak of Swami taking on people's karma, did he do so consciously as well? Was there any difference the way Swami could help disciples work out karma compared to an avatar? Well, okay, let's just take the parts of this. Yes, Master took on people's karma consciously. When Swami takes on people's karma, of course it has to be consciously. To do something like transferring negative energy from one person to yourself, that isn't done passively or kind of offhandedly. It has to be done consciously. Once someone asked Swamiji, because he was ill at the time, they said, Swami, because he didn't like to admit any particular, I don't know, powers or anything like that. They asked Swami, are you taking on other people's karma with all your illnesses? And he was very quiet for a while. And then he said, we all have to do our part, meaning this is what I'm able to do. So when you say, is there any difference the way Swami would help his disciples and compare to an avatar? Yes and no. It's not a difference of kind, it's a difference of degree. So an avatar could totally free a person from their karma, raise people from the dead, you know, all these sort of things. Swami was very clear and very strong with us, saying, I am not on the level of our gurus. I do not want to be considered one of the gurus after I pass. But nevertheless, what is the operative consciousness that enables an avatar or a high saint like Swami to take on other people's karma? Compassion. It's compassion for other people's suffering, and that's the operative agent in that process. So yes, it's different in, as I say, not in kind, but in degree.
Let me add an amendment to that, because I think it's important. Without going into the story, there was a time where a woman in New York about to go into an operation was very frightened, and she saw physically Swami come into her room, sit on her bed, and stroke her arm. felt it physically. Swami was on the West Coast at the time. Now, when he heard that, he said, I have no conscious knowledge of having done that. But this is the important thing. He said, the soul is perfectly capable of operating separately from the personality. And so a high soul has a degree of freedom to operate. So was Swami conscious of it? Maybe his personality wasn't, but his soul was. So as Devi said in the fuller answer, these things don't happen just by chance. There is a decision of compassion to try to help someone.
Maybe we just go to the two online questions and then we'll come back to the written questions.
Thank you, Jyotish and Devi. One of the questions that we received online, for newer devotees on the path, how are we to relate and interact with people we have known for many years, but may not understand the changes we are making? I find myself wanting to engage less, but then have guilt over it. How best do we proceed in situations like this?
Should we repeat, or were you picked up on the?
I think we're good.
Just keep going. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting question. To a certain extent, as we develop on the spiritual path, as the spiritual path becomes more important to us, it's going to separate us from people that we've known for a long time. Many people experience going and visiting their family, and it feels like, yes, it's very nice to visit your family, but you can only express one layer of who you are. You can't express your deeper self. And so you're just not drawn to interact so much. It's just part of life. Don't feel guilty. Guilt is a completely unhelpful kind of emotion. Just accept the fact that people do gradually grow apart.
And just to add to this, because it's an important question, some of your old friends will be open and respectful. Some will be mocking. And those are the ones you don't want to hang out with. But the ones that are saying, it's really kind of neat what you're doing. I'd like to learn more about it. I don't think I'll do it, but I see it's doing good for you. So you have to, old friends are not, do not all fall into one category.
Last question presented online is, Naiswami Devi mentioned today that we should strive to love everyone with impersonal and unconditional love. How do you translate that when it comes to one's children?
That's such a nice question. I think it's something that you have to really grow into when your children are quite young and totally dependent on you. It's hard to have impersonal love. But as they start to mature and to express their own independence, then more and more it's important for them, for their development, to not be clinging and attached and, oh, you're my baby and all that, but to give them space, to give them a sense of respect for their own individual soul and their own individual soul's development. And remember, impersonal love isn't cold, but it's just not, the essence of impersonal love is that it doesn't, you're not connecting it with your sense of ego. This is my child, my husband, whatever. But just to, I can love with a sense of freedom and love the God in that other person. And I know, I'll just share from our own experience. We have a grown son, the one that was born during the fire. He's 45 years old now. And we really share a beautiful impersonal love and friendship. And I'm grateful to Master very much for that relationship. But you have to be willing to support, guide, train, be present for, help in times of need, but at the same time, with a total sense of non-attachment. And it's something we all have to grow into.
Is it better to live alone than with a non-spiritual community, like a permaculture off-the-grid community? And then how would one even begin to set up a small community of devotees? Are there forums within the Ananda Online Community Network for these sorts of discussions? Living alone or in community? If you're a serious devotee and you're living with other, living closely with other non-devotees who are quite demanding, it's almost like permaculture can become an alternate religion, and you're expected to really be into that. Honestly, I would say it would be better to live alone and live with other devotees, because the magnetism of their devotion to something that's non-spiritual or non-consciously along the path will act as a block. In terms of setting up a community, it's a very, very difficult thing to do. I would say come here and live for a while, or certainly work with the Ananda virtual community, and they could set up a forum and help advise you. But it's a very difficult thing to do, to create a community.
Okay, we're closing in on it. You've recently encouraged Radio Ananda to play the Gayatri Mantra continuously for 24 hours to put a high vibration into the ether. Could you talk on the power of mantras in general, and more particularly the Gayatri Mantra? How does this mantra fit into the yogic lifestyle? Okay, well, I'll try to answer succinctly. This idea of playing Gayatri Mantra continuously on Radio Ananda came about, we were reading a beautiful book about Anandamoyi Ma, and in 1948, at the time of the partition in India, separation of Pakistan and India, where there was tremendous suffering and bloodshed and violence, Ma said, "We must do something." Anandamoyi Ma said, "We must do something to bring uplifting vibration." And she started something called the Savitri Puja, where they were, for 24 hours a day, they were chanting Gayatri Mantra as part of a puja, fire ceremony. And this went on for 4 years, nonstop. And, you know, when I heard that, I thought, that's how the great ones work. It's like you can't stop this person from being violent or this person from being irrational, but you can put that vibration out. So that's why we're doing it. Gayatri Mantra is known as the highest mantra in the Vedic scriptures. Is a part of the yogic lifestyle. It is not part of our teachings. It is not part of our path. Master recommended if we want to do a mantra, just do Om Guru, Om Guru. But this is for a different purpose. This is to change the consciousness of the planet. So that was the thinking behind that.
If you're interested, there is an absolutely charming story told by our friend Murali. You can find it on YouTube, The Origin of the Gayatri Mantra. It's been viewed by more than 1 million people. And it is wonderful. He's a great, great storyteller.
Okay, next question.
Okay, next question. We have two more, and one is a...
Three more.
But I'm going to get these two together, and then the last one is a quick question. Why do you think Master recommended Thomas Akempis's book, Imitation of Christ, unreservedly? Though many concepts are beautiful and deeply inspiring, some of the concepts seem to me to be opposite to what he taught, self-abnegation versus self-forgetfulness as one example. Why did he not add with some reservations? I don't know. You know, when Swami was just quoting him, sometimes he would say something in a particular group of people or in a particular time or space, but what he was working probably at that time with the monks, and he was trying to get them to, his main point was that book taught you how to become a Christ, not just to worship a Christ. And that was his recommendation. But I too sometimes will read about or the diaries of kind of medieval saints, and you have to read them with a grain of salt because some concepts in there are beautiful but stated in a way that with discrimination, such as self-abnegation, that's not really a helpful part of the path. It was at that time, maybe. And then it says, I heard Yogananda mention a story that Tolstoy told. As a fan of Tolstoy, I'm wondering, was there any connection between Master and Tolstoy? Not that I know of. I suspect Master must have read or heard something of Tolstoy's story, and Tolstoy was a very spiritual person, has some beautiful stories, but I don't know of any direct connection between them.
Okay, last question. I'm going to give you a facetious answer and then the real answer. Can you explain why you always wear blue? Well, it's easier when you're doing laundry if you only have one color, because then the colors don't run together. That's not the true reason.
And then you can say, you know, this is a blue bottom and a blue top. What kind of accessory goes with this? Blue. And then there you have it. It makes things so simple.
No, the real answer is in 2009, Swami Kriyananda founded what he called the Naya Swami Order. And it was a new, Naya means new, Swami is someone who's seeking union with the higher self. And it was a new kind of renunciate order, open to householders, to married people, to single people, people on our path, people, we have Christian monks and nuns who are Naya Swamis, we have Buddhists, we have people from many different religious backgrounds. It's not part of Ananda's membership, so to speak, but there are many of our members who have taken the Naya Swami vows, and it's essentially, and the color that we wear is blue, and so that's why we're always wearing blue, and it's essentially, the vow you take as a Naya Swami is essentially that you will live the rest of your life for God alone, that if you are married, you will see your spouse belonging only to God, and that all of your life's experiences are funneled toward ultimate union with God. So that maybe is a good way to end.
I'll just add a quick amendment, or addition. Swami said that the orange or ochre of traditional Swami represents kind of renunciation where you toss into the fire. It represents kind of a color of fire, all attachments. And he said that the new Swami order, instead of be worldly renouncing, should be samadhi affirming. And so the color blue is part of the spiritual eye. And so using that color blue helps to draw the energy up and into the union with God. So the Naya Swami order is samadhi affirming. And also renouncing those attachments to the world.
Okay, we did it. We answered
That's
all
it.
Of your questions. And thank you for asking such good ones. And we can tell by the questions that you're studying autobiography of a yogi, which is great. And also just to let you know, we will be offering for those who have enrolled in Inner Renewal Week significant discounts on the books we're referring to if you don't already own them, Autobiography and Conversations with Yogananda, Essence of the Bhagavad Gita. So if you don't have any of these books, then this is a good time to buy them, either electronically, digitally, or in a physical copy. So God bless you all. And we will, Jyotish and I will see you on Friday. And tomorrow we'll have a wonderful panel talking about Master's mission in creating world brotherhood communities. God bless you all.